The message you are about to hear is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
Let's begin today by going to 1 Corinthians 10. 1 Corinthians 10. Today we read in the reading about Assyria. And it's a coincidence, actually, that my subject today is on that very topic, the king of Assyria. There are times in our lives, I'm sure you've experienced this, where you get letters that you don't want. It was a while back someone had recommended a movie to me called We Were Soldiers. In the movie, they went through the story of a portion of the Vietnam War. There had been a severe attack on some American troops. It was a massacre. And our government wanted to go in secretly, and they wanted to destroy these people. And so they got some of the best men they had. They were underfunded, and then they pulled some of the troops so that they actually were undermanned. And they sent this group, this force, in with helicopters into the jungle, and there they expected them to wipe out the Viet Cong that were there. It turned out that they were vastly undermanned. It was 400 to 1. And they sent these soldiers in, and they fought valiantly, and some of them were really massacred. And they gave it all they had. And what I still can't get out of my mind in the images were back on the base where the families lived, they began to get letters that would roll in, the letters of the men killed. And the wives all knew each other, and the families kind of hung together. And the wife whose husband was leading this attack in the jungle, she determined that she would take each letter to the family. And the shock, the look of horror, the anguish, the agony that I saw in the faces, I know it was just a movie, but I know it demonstrated something that was real. They got letters telling them their husband was dead. Families, their children's fathers, were dead. These were letters they really didn't want to get. You could feel the terrible loss. You could feel the pain. How about you? Have you ever gotten a letter that you didn't want to get, one that you feared? Today I want to talk about a letter from the devil. It was a threatening letter, and I think if we received a letter from the devil, I think we would be terrified. So there was a king who got such a letter. It was signed by Sennacherib, actually, but I think that Sennacherib was a type of kind of representative of the devil in one sense. So I want us today to consider this in this context. The nations are considered to belong to the devil, aren't they? He's the god of this world. And when he offered, the devil did, to Jesus, the kingdoms of this world, he could do so, couldn't he? Because they were his to offer. In another case, Daniel had prayed to God and asking him about understanding the prophecies of Jeremiah, and an angel, Gabriel, came to him. And the angel told him, I was held up for 21 days. I would have been here sooner, but it was the prince of Persia that detained me and resisted me. And Michael had to come, or else, you know, to help me so that I could come to you. But you understand, there's no human prince that could stop an angel like Gabriel or Michael. So who was really the prince that was being talked about? Was it Satan? Really? I think it was, because you understand the prince of Persia was going to be used to let God's people go. It was the kingdom that was going to come up next. And I can see Satan there influencing that prince, trying to somehow ruin God's prophecy, somehow derail it so it wouldn't happen. Here's another case. In the scriptures, God speaks of the prince of Tyre. And then suddenly the scriptures turn and they lift to speak directly to Lucifer. Why? Well, I'm suggesting because it is Lucifer, Satan, who was the real power behind the throne. That's who he was really talking to. That was the being that was influencing the king of Tyre. I believe that it was the prince of Persia. It was really Satan was the power behind the throne. And so it was. Sennacherib was at this point the king of the most powerful force, the most powerful empire in the world. And I believe that he was, Satan was, the power behind Sennacherib's throne. And so it is that Sennacherib writes a letter to a king, and I believe that it was inspired by and influenced by Satan himself. Assyria was so powerful at that time, but it was also something else. It was the most brutal nation. It was vicious, and it was cruel. And it's my personal opinion, that's why that nation isn't listed in the image that in the dream of Daniel. It could have been listed. It could have just been another color. But my point today is that I think that God ignores them as a civilization, because even though while they amassed vast numbers of people under one king, and they brought together a powerful, powerful empire, God thought it was just a terrible nation, vicious and cruel. Whereas you remember, Nebuchadnezzar was changed, a changed man. He supported God. But I remember reading accounts of Sennacherib and others in the Assyrian Empire and their brutality, and what they even did with the corpses is unspeakable of the people. And so the king of Assyria was this man named Sennacherib, and that word means sin. It means the moon god and sin, but it also means, it comes from that basic root, but it means who multiplies brothers. And so I believe this man, inspired by Satan, the devil, assembled the first great empire, and like Nimrod, he amassed many others to follow him, many other kingdoms that he conquered, and he required those conquered nations to worship his God. And by so doing, you see, he's multiplying brothers in the hatred, in the opposition of God. And so I think this is important for this reason. Sennacherib had a great impact on the people called Israel. And those people called Israel have a history, and that history was written for us. And it says this in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 11. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, on whom the ends of the ages have come. And so here we have the scriptures telling us that those things that happened to Israel were written down, and they were written for an example for us. Us who would live at the end of the age in particular. And so I want us to learn today a lesson from this incident that happened with Sennacherib. That I believe there are types and shadows, and that there are lessons from those examples in the lives of men and women who lived back in the times of old that are for us. That we can learn principles, we can learn lessons from all of those. And so I want us to begin by understanding this overall story, if you will, because I think it relates to us who live at the end of the age. I think there's some parallels that are worth recognizing. Let's go to 2 Kings. 2 Kings 17, if you will. Consider for a moment a possible way in which Israel foreshadowed something in the that relates to the end time church. Jesus Christ had brought all of Israel out of Egypt. They all came out. And then they went through seven eras of these people. There were the first era where they did not, or were those people who knew Moses directly, who was a type of Christ. Then there was an era of the judges when they suffered persecution, like the second era of the New Testament. There was the united monarchy where they prospered and they were helped by God. Then there was a divided monarchy where they had to deal with Jezebel, as you remember. Then there was a period of captivity in which there was relative near invisibility. They weren't seen to exist even though they did. Then there was a restoration under Ezra and Nehemiah. It was the sixth one. And then there was the last era, the one of the Pharisees. And they existed just before Christ's first coming, and a type very much of the era at the end of the age when Christ comes a second time. So spanning this entire history and these different eras that came and went during the time of Israel, I think there's a message for us in it. Because in time, the people forgot Moses, and they suffered at the hand of the oppressive neighbors. God helped them. They rose from obscurity to a powerful nation under that united monarchy. And then there was a massive apostasy of the larger portion of Israel. And they had affected this whole main body. They were then pulled away, separated. God says he rent them. He tore them away, the northern tribes, because of their apostasy. And what it was that he named? They were worshiping Ashtoreth, that is, Easter today. Then there was a small remnant still left, and that was Judah. And they came under attack also. They were not really a lot better than Israel. And eventually, that smaller body that was more faithful became corrupt, and they too eventually went into captivity. And so is there a lesson for us today in all of this? I say there is. Isn't it like our experience at the end of the age? The larger body becomes corrupt, and they are now gone, and they have lost their identity? And isn't there a smaller remnant that has attempted to hold fast? And doesn't that smaller remnant, aren't they kind of proud of themselves for doing it? And don't they think, well, God is with us because we held fast? But aren't they allowing themselves to slip? Aren't they becoming weaker? Isn't the Church of God today still kind of almost in gray ways, watermarked ways, if you will, going back, compromising, weakening on doctrine and teaching? I believe it's true. So with that understanding, or looking at it in that perspective, of the overall vision of Israel, I want to bring it down and look at one part of what happened to the group who held fast. Because while they were fairly corrupt, something happened. They got a new king, and that king was Hezekiah, and he orchestrated reform there. So let's notice this in 2 Kings in 17, where it talks about what happened to Israel. 2 Kings 17. And verse 15. Where here it speaks of Israel, the northern tribes. They had rejected his statutes and his covenant they had made with their fathers, and his testimonies which he had testified against them. They followed idols, they became idolaters, and they went after the nations who were all around them concerning the Lord, had charged them that they should not do like them. So they left off the commandments of the Lord their God. They made for themselves a molded image and two calves and made a wooden image and worshipped all the host of heaven and served Baal. And they caused their sons and daughters to pass through the fire. They practiced witchcraft, soothsaying, and sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. Therefore the Lord was very angry with Israel, and he removed them from his sight, and there was none left but the tribe of Judah alone. And I say this can be compared to the apostasy that struck the worldwide Church of God today. They returned to what they were called out of, didn't they? Yes. And they became full of compromise, adultery, and pleasure-seeking. And so it is that the devil no longer has any need to threaten them or to tempt them, because they are within his control now. And there are ministers of light preaching, that is, appearing to be ministers of light, preaching from those pulpits. 2 Kings 18. I believe Judah can be compared, and there can be an analogy made of Judah in the end time church. Really not much more righteous than Israel at the time that the apostasy struck. But she followed the apostate Israel's lead to a certain degree, and then a new king came into power there. 2 Kings 18. And now it came to pass in the third year of Hoshea, the son of Elah, king of Israel, that Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Abi, the daughter of Zechariah. And he did what was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father David had done. He removed the high places, broke down the sacred pillars, cut down the wooden images, broke to pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made, for until those days the children of Israel burned incense to it and called it a Nehushtan. He trusted in the Lord God of Israel, so that after him was none like him, according to among all the kings of Judah, nor any who were before him. For he held fast to the Lord, and he didn't depart from following him, but he kept his commandments, which the Lord God had commanded Moses. And the Lord was with him, and he prospered wherever he went. And he rebelled against the king of Assyria, and did not serve him. And he subdued the Philistines as far as Gaza and its territory, from watchtower to fortified city. And so here it is that we have a king who is striving to do God's way in this remnant, sincerely striving. And this little kingdom of Judah then seemed to restore the truth. They had the nerve to resist the great satanic king. And the devil, what was his response? Could he allow such a thing to occur? Now, until the time of Hezekiah, Judah was in bondage to the Assyrian king. And he and Judah regularly gave tribute to this king. Hezekiah, he decided, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to pay tribute to him. And so Sennacherib came down, and he took as far as Lachish, a very prominent city that you can read about in archaeological digs today. 2 Kings 18 and verse 13. And in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them. And he took them because he had turned to Egypt for help instead of looking to God at the time. And Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish, saying, I have done wrong. Turn away from me. Whatever you impose on me, I'll pay. And the king of Assyria assessed Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. So Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of the Lord, in the treasuries of the king's house. And at that time Hezekiah stripped the gold from the doors of the temple of the Lord and from the pillars which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid, and he gave it to the king of Assyria. You see what happened? Hezekiah caved in. He compromised. What a perfect picture to me of God's church who have tried to remain faithful today. The church sometimes walks today in fear, intimidated by the opinion of other people and even the opinion of the world. And that's what's happening. We are accommodating them in some cases. We're so soft on homosexuality today. We are afraid to speak out and condemn abortion. We're afraid to say who the whore really is. We're afraid of it because what'll they think of us? We're sometimes afraid to speak out powerfully on the Ten Commandments and indict a nation because they aren't keeping them, and to talk about God's holy days right out in public strongly and powerfully. We're afraid of it. I say the church, by so doing, pays tribute to Satan. And we do it sometimes by what we listen to. We do it sometimes by what it is that we watch, the movies we go to. The kind of standards we hold today, what we spend our money on, what our values are today, have they been compromised? So much we fear disapproval from others. I ask us today, what are we going to say in the resurrection when we talk to the people in the first century that faced lions, that were burned at the stake, the people that went through the Inquisition? Are we going to tell them, well, we had to be careful about what we said? It's going to be embarrassing to face our brethren who suffered so much when we're afraid to speak out, when we compromise. Hezekiah was next tempted again. He was tempted there, and he became afraid, and he caved in. And sometimes we do that too. There was a lot of pressure this time, 2 Kings 18, verse 17. Then the king of Assyria sent Tartan and Rabsaris and Rabshakeh, from Lachish. Rabbi Sheka was his cupbearer, with a great army against Jerusalem to King Hezekiah. And they went up and they came to Jerusalem, and when they had come up, they came and stood by the aqueduct from the upper pool, which was on the highway to the fuller's field. And when they had called to the king, Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, Shebna the scribe, and Joah the son of Asaph, the recorder, came out to them. And Reb Sheka said to them, "Say now to Hezekiah, thus says the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this in which you trust? You speak of having counsel and strength of war, but they are vain words, and whom do you trust, that you rebel against me?" I went and actually read what Sennacherib had written, and I didn't feel there was time enough to read it. But this man was so proud, so full of pride, it just reeked with it, the damage he could do to others, and how destructive he was, and how he was feared, and who he was. Just sentence after sentence of it, something he had written after conquering Lachish. "Now look, you're trusting in the staff of this broken reed Egypt." So they had trusted in Egypt, and God had, because they had trusted in Egypt, didn't protect them, and they lost some of their surrounding cities. "On which if a man leans, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who trust him. But if you say to me, 'We trust in the Lord our God,' is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah has taken away and said to Judah and Jerusalem, 'You shall worship before this altar in Jerusalem'?" And so he's reminding them, you know, that Hezekiah here, your king, he took away the gods you used to worship. And he's telling you, you have to worship this one down here in Jerusalem. So you've lost a lot of your fun, lost Christmas kind of things and Easter kind of things, you might say today. And so he's trying to turn them against their king. "Now therefore I urge you, give a pledge to my master the king of Assyria, and I'll give you 2,000 horses if you're able on your part to put riders on them." And so he wanted 2,000 men as a pledge that he wouldn't fight against them. They would ride on these horses he'd give them. "Now then, will you repel one captain? How? How are you going to repel one captain of the least of my master's servants and put your trust in Egypt for chariots and horsemen? Have I now come up without the Lord against this place to destroy it?" And then he says, "The Lord said to me, 'Go up against this land and destroy it.'" And that's capital L-O-R-D. Here he is telling them, Yahweh, your God, told me, come up here and destroy this land. Then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, Shebna, and Joah said to the Rabbi Sheka, "Please speak to your servants in the Aramaic language, for we understand it. Do not speak to us in the Hebrew in the hearing of the people who are on the wall." Rabbi Sheka said unto them, "Has my master sent me to your master and to you to speak these words, and not to the men who sit on the wall, who will eat and drink their own waste with you?" And then Reb Sheka stood and called out in a loud voice in Hebrew and spoke, saying, "Hear the word of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus says the king, do not let Hezekiah deceive you, for he shall not be able to deliver you from his hand. Nor let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, 'The Lord will surely deliver us.' This city shall not be given under the hand of the king of Assyria. Don't listen to Hezekiah, for thus says the king of Assyria, make peace with me by present." That is, give me a gift. Give me these 2,000 men. Make peace with me. Doesn't that sound like Satan talking to us when we're in trials and temptations and tribulation? Oh yeah. Make peace with me. "And come out to me, and every one of you eat from his own vine, and every one from his own fig tree, and every one of you drink the waters of your own cistern. Why have to fight? Until I come and take you away to a land like your own land, a land with grain, new wine, a land of bread and vineyards, a land of olive groves and honey, you may be able to live and not die." Oh yeah, I'll relocate you. I will. "But it's going to be a good land, and you'll have ease there, and you'll be able to prosper. Don't listen to Hezekiah, lest he persuade you, saying, 'The Lord will deliver us.' Has any of the gods of the nations at all delivered its land from the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of Shepharvim and Hena and Iva? Indeed, have they delivered Samaria from my hand?" No. He took all of Samaria, didn't he? "Who among the gods of the lands have delivered their countries from my hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem from my hand? But the people held their peace and answered him not a word, for the king's commandment was, do not answer him. And then Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, who was over the household, Shebna and the scribe, and Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder, came to Hezekiah with their clothes torn, and they told him the words of the cupbearer. I see this very much as similar to the test of the church at the end of the age. Two aspects that I want to bring out. One applies to us now, and one will apply to the church in the end of the age. It certainly is a test of us now, if you think about it. We are tempted while we're in this world now, and while we're at peace, we're tempted by Him. And the temptation is, cut a deal with me, compromise, and you can remain at peace. You can pay a tribute to the devil, can't you? And keep the peace. No opposition, no war, no suffering, you see. Hezekiah faced the same issue you and I do today in one sense. You can give in, and we can be at peace. We can trust completely with the Lord, can't we? And what does that mean? Opposition is what it means. It sometimes means persecution. It means we'll be at war with our enemies. Once we decide to follow God, there sometimes is enormous opposition, and we're tempted severely, and we end up being under siege. The representatives of Satan's world will mock our trust in God, won't they? You're going to lose out. You'll find that God isn't going to help you. Your faith isn't going to work. Your God's no different from all the other gods of everybody else around in the world. The impotent gods, they'll say, impotent. Honoring Him won't deliver you, they'll say. No reason to maintain your faith. No reason to maintain it. It's unfounded. Then the devil will turn it around. He's the prince of the power of the air. And he'll broadcast things from other people or even in our own mind. Thoughts like, really, it's God's fault. You see the point? Yes, it's God's fault. He doesn't have your best interests at heart. Isn't that what Satan did with Eve? Yes. And he'll try to make it look like it's God who's bringing the trial on us. That's what he'll do, just like this wicked king accused. So it's God who wants you to suffer, God who wants you to cave in. Can any of you here at all relate to what I'm saying? Have any of you found yourselves in kind of a mess at times, deep trouble? How about unemployed? How about bills mounting and you don't know how they're going to get paid? Has anybody had their family turn against them? Ever felt abandoned? Ever felt alone? Others saying that they know what God's will is in your case? You should do this. Or the Lord told me that this is what you should do. Cave in here. Be at ease. Be at peace. That kind of attack sometimes will make anyone want to give up. It looks like sometimes in life like God may have forsaken us. And sometimes we'll think, well, maybe it's my past sins, and maybe it's what I've done, and God isn't with me, and He won't protect me. And sometimes it is made to look like our trials have come because we've trusted in God. That's the reason why we're suffering. And it can cause us to think, look at all the ministers who failed. Well, how can I stand? Look at the experiences I've had, the people I've trusted, even who claim to be believers, and have suffered at their hand. You see, this is the mentality that will be broadcast by the enemy right now as we live, as the remnant of those trying to stay faithful. What about at the end of the age? I want you to think about this for a minute. The pressure is really going to mount at the end of the age. There is going to be a modern-day Assyria, a modern-day king of the north. It is going to be a beast power. He's going to speak unimaginable things against the great God, put Him down, put Himself up, and He's going to magnify Himself in a very similar way. And He's going to try to buy people with flatteries. Oh yeah, it'll go good with you. Just go along with me, right? Yes, and some will commit to this, and some will turn against us, and some will turn others in because of the flatteries in order to save their own skin. The time's coming when the remnant of God's church will face this. What are we going to do? Well, what are we going to do right now? That's an indicator, isn't it, of how we'll act then. Will we turn? Will we sell out to save our skins? It's going to look so overwhelming. It's going to scare us. And there's one purpose that the devil has for this. He has a purpose in mind. He wants you to take one little step, one little compromise, one little cut a deal with me. You can have peace. It all goes away. All the problems go away. Just cut the deal with me. You can have peace, prosperity. It'll be okay with you. So he'll broadcast this. Come on, make a deal, cut a deal, compromise a little. Think of what your life could be like if you do. It'll be a lot easier for you. He'll make it sound good. And so he is tempting the church today, the way he tempted Hezekiah and the way he tempted the people on the wall then. But I ask us today, think of the consequences. We cave in, we become the slave of that devil. We'll be his subjects. We will forever pay tribute to him. We will. And if we compromise at the end, I want us to think we'll go into captivity. There'll be terrible consequences to pay, unimaginable suffering, perhaps even missing out on the kingdom of God. Remember, there's a day of the Lord coming, and he protects, he puts a seal on his people to protect them from what is going to happen. I want that more than I want the ease of what that devil can give to me. Hezekiah told him, don't say a word to him. That's pretty good advice, isn't it? That's a pretty good strategy. You know, we're being tempted by the devil or by Satan. Don't answer. Don't engage in the conversation. Just back out of it. Don't answer him. I think it's a great point. Anyway, Hezekiah had the presence of mind to ask God's prophet Hezekiah to pray for this situation. 2 Kings 19. And so it was that when the king Hezekiah heard it, that he tore his clothes and covered himself with sackcloth, and he went into the house of the Lord. He was just beside himself. You can imagine. You know, what we read about was the history of real people facing real problems and real threats. That's not just a story. This guy was threatening their lives, and it could be they were going to be shredded by this vicious and cruel king. Then he sent Eliakim, who was over the household, Shebna the scribe, and the elders of the priests, covered with sackcloth, to Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amos. And they said to him, thus says Hezekiah, this day is a day of trouble and rebuke and blasphemy, for the children have come to birth, but there's no strength to bring them forth. It may be that the Lord your God will hear all the words of Rabshakeh from his master, the king of Assyria, has sent to reproach the living God. And perhaps he'll reprove the words which the Lord your God has heard. Therefore, lift up your prayer for the remnant that is left. So the servants of King Hezekiah came to Isaiah, and Isaiah said this to them. You shall say to your master, thus says the Lord, do not be afraid of the words which you've heard, which the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me. Surely I will send a spirit upon them, and he shall hear a rumor and return to his own land, and I'll cause him to fall by the sword in his own land. And so we're tempted to compromise, like Hezekiah was. But his example is a good one to us. When he was tempted, he turned to God. And he determined he would rely on God. So what do you think Satan does then? He ups the ante, doesn't he? So at first he was tempted with ease. At first he was tempted with being able to have a good life, release from the pressure. Now he is going to be threatened. That's what Satan does. He'll threaten us. And that's the way he works. 2 Kings 19 and verse 14. This time, the messengers carried a letter threatening Hezekiah, and he read the letter, and he prayed for God's help. In verse 14, it says this, Hezekiah received the letter from the hand of the messengers, and he read it. And Hezekiah went up to the house of the Lord, and he spread it before the Lord. And Hezekiah prayed before the Lord and said, O Lord God of Israel, the one who dwells between the cherubim, you are God. You alone in all the kingdoms of the earth, you have made heaven and earth. Incline your ear, O Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, O Lord, and see and hear the words of Sennacherib, which he has sent to reproach the living God. Truly, Lord, the king of Assyria has laid waste the nations and their lands. This is true. He's not lying about that. And they've cast their gods into the fire. for they were not gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. Therefore they've destroyed them. Now therefore, O Lord our God, I pray, save us from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you are the Lord God, and you alone. So have you ever received your letter from the devil? Have you gotten ever divorce papers in the mail? Have you ever got a notice of termination from work? How about a letter from the IRS? Has somebody ever knocked and had a letter for you that says you have to pay this or you're going to jail? How about a letter that's an x-ray? How about lab reports? Have you ever gotten your letter? Have you ever gotten a bill you couldn't pay? Remember the terrifying bill that the Irwin family received? Thousands of dollars? What do you do? How do you react? Letters like this one are tragic and terrifying. Have you received a letter of the death of a loved one? These letters are like the ones sent to Hezekiah, and they're intended to distract us and weaken our faith, to frighten and confuse, to undermine our focus, to get us off track. And they can work pretty effectively. There's an illustration I want to talk about that I think makes this point. Major William Martin was a British subject. He was in the British military. He was buried on the southern coast of Spain, ultimately. And he never did get to see any battles because he died of pneumonia in the hospital. But the Allies had a plan. They had recently invaded North Africa. They wanted to take Sicily next. That's what the Allies wanted to do. But they knew that the Axis powers would figure that out too, and that that's where they would go, and they would have a major battle. And so they said they were going to try to trick the Axis powers. So what they did was they took Major Martin's body in a submarine, and they went outside the coast there, and they took his body and put it in a raft, and they gave him one oar, and they put inside his pocket a letter. And the letter was to be secret. And the letter described plans for an invasion of Greece. And they pushed the raft towards the shore. And then what happened was the Axis powers found him. He had drifted into shore. They read the letter and sent it to the Nazi headquarters. And the Nazi headquarters believed it. And they sent all their troops over to Greece, you see. And then the Allies could go into Spain, where there would not have to fight the big battle. But you understand my point. We can read letters, and we can take them as though they're really big, they're really important, and we can be distracted by it. We can be misled by it. Hezekiah wasn't misled, was he? Because he trusted God, and he was going to do what God said, no matter what some letter told him, no matter what it appeared the reality was. And so today we have a government that invests lots of money in developing a certain department of the government. It's the intelligence agency, isn't it? Yes. They spend a lot of money trying to know the enemy. They want to know the moves the enemy's likely to make. They want to know their language. They want to know everything about them. What about us? Do we know the enemy? Do we realize the tactics? We're not ignorant of his devices, but sometimes we act like we are ignorant. And so we get off track. We get distracted by letters that come, you might say. So I ask us today, realize he'll tempt you with ease at first. He'll tempt you with pleasure at first. He'll offer an easy solution that isn't God's solution to us. And if that doesn't work, he'll threaten. You'll find yourself under great pressure. When he does it, what is our response? Do we spread the letter? Do we spread what it is we fear before our great God? And are we going to trust him, fully trust him? 2 Kings 19, Hezekiah trusted God, and he went to Isaiah. And then Isaiah, in verse 20, the son of Amos sent to Hezekiah, saying, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, That which you have prayed to me against Sennacherib, king of Israel, I have heard. And this is the word which the Lord has spoken concerning him. The virgin, the daughter of Zion, has despised you, laughed you to scorn. The daughter of Jerusalem has shaken her head behind your back. Whom have you reproached and blasphemed? Against whom have you raised your voice and lifted up your eyes on high? And then he tells them who it is. Against the Holy One of Israel. Wow. To me, this is so profound. And it's so powerful. And it's so reassuring. God took the letter personally, didn't he? He took this letter personally. You haven't written this to my children. You've written this letter to me, he says. And the children of Israel, big guy, hate you. They despise you and they laugh at you. They mock at you. They shake their head in disbelief that you could be this foolish as to challenge the God of Israel. Yes. Who have you blasphemed? No less than the God of Israel. To me, this is a clear picture. The king of Assyria isn't going to take on the armies of Judah. He's not taking on Hezekiah. He's taking on a king of much greater proportions than he ever thought. He's taking on the king of the universe. How foolish he was to think that he was going against Hezekiah. He thought that Judah's God was just like the other gods, and he's going to learn a very powerful lesson in verse 23. Verse 23, by your messengers you have reproached the Lord. He said, and by the multitude of my chariots you've said, I've come up to the height of the mountains, to the limits of Lebanon. I'll cut down all its tall cedars and its choice cypress trees. I'll enter the extremity of its borders to the fruitful forest. And I've dug and drunk strange water, and with the soles of my feet I've dried up all the brooks of defense. Yes. He had no idea that it was actually the Eternal, however. That's what he thought he was going to do. I'm going to do all this to you. But they didn't know he was fighting against God himself. And they didn't know this. Just like in the case of Pharaoh, God had allowed the king of Assyria to grow in this kind of power. Come on. Come on, he's saying. As he said, bring it on. Because I've raised you to this power for a purpose. Because I'm going to show you who I really am. Did you not hear long ago, God says, how I made it from ancient times and that I formed it? And now I've brought it to pass that you should be for crushing fortified cities into heaps and ruins? I allowed this. I'm the one that is responsible. Therefore, their inhabitants had little power. They were dismayed and confounded. They were as the grass on the field and the green herb, as the grass on the housetops and the grains blighted. But I know your dwelling place. And you're going out, and you're coming in. Yes, God knew every move he made, every decision behind every closed door, every battle attack plan. God was aware of every single bit of it. And he says, and I knew your rage against me, because your rage against me and your tumult have come up to my ears. Therefore, I put my hook in your nose, my bridle in your lips, and turn you back by the way in which you came. This shall be a sign to you. You'll eat this year such as grows of itself, and in the second year, what springs from the same also, in the third year, sow and reap, plant vineyards, and eat the fruit of them. And so the commentaries all say that this was a sign to Hezekiah at what God was going to do. The first year, the land had been ravaged by the Assyrian king Sennacherib. The second year, it says in the Encyclopedia Judaica, that they were keeping the sabbatical years at this time. And they believed that that was a sabbatical year. And so they would eat what would grow out of the land for 2 years that hadn't been planted. And so that had to be a miraculous sign. The city would live off that. Then the third year, they would plant. And the third year, they would eat what grew of the land. And they'd be able to reap the harvest then. And so it was that God destroyed He promised to destroy this incredible army, and he promised a final end to the Assyrians. And we start that in verse 30. And the remnant, he says, who have escaped of the house of Judah shall again take root and downward and bear fruit upward. For out of Jerusalem shall go a remnant, and those who have escaped from Mount Zion. Then he says, the zeal of the Lord of hosts shall do this. And so I remind us today that they were saved not by natural means. And that's what that sign of the 3 years was for them. They knew, there was no question, it was not natural means. God would miraculously save them. And today, I remind us, the future's coming. A time in which the church of God is going to be under attack by a king of the north. There's going to be a beast power. A great tribulation is coming. And the people of God are going to have an army go after them. And these people will again be protected miraculously by God. These people will again be miraculously fed. And after the third year, they too will produce fruit. Spiritual fruit, as they will one day lead the people of Jerusalem to know the true God. And we can be a part of that, and we're called to that. And so God destroyed these Assyrian armies then. He'll destroy it again by an incredible miracle. In verse 35, it says this, "And it came to pass on a certain night that the angel of the Lord went out and killed in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when the people arose," that is the survivors, "early in the morning, there were the corpses all dead." 185,000. "So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went away, returned home, and remained at Nineveh. Now it came to pass as he was worshiping the temple of his God that his sons struck him down with the sword, and they escaped to the land of Ararat. And then Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his stead." And so I suggest that this story of Judah, the remnant, is a good lesson, a study in trusting God. At first, Hezekiah compromised. We've all experienced that, haven't we, at one time and another in our lives. We've compromised. Caved into Sennacherib, the devil, if you will, gave him tribute and so on. Let's go to Revelation 3. The evil king of sin wanted to make Hezekiah a brother of sin, didn't he? Tempted him with pressure, then threatened him with suffering. He could cave in and have peace. Then this great king, influenced by the devil, sent a letter. And he's now threatening this little nation. And he spoke against God and tried to undermine their faith. Hezekiah trusted in God regardless. And he came to a point where he actually put it all on the line. And he resisted this devil-inspired king. He resisted the devil. And what happened? Well, as James said, the devil fled from him. We're like Judah today. We've been under the sway of the devil. He's conquered the larger group, wants to conquer us, as it were. And we have, I think, been lukewarm, and I think we have compromised in many ways. And today I ask us, are we compromising with God and with the truth and with the doctrines we understand? Others are compromising, and we sometimes compromise now in the way we live. Soon, we will be threatened with our lives. I believe we're living in the end of the age. Will we then trust God? Will we trust God and resist the devil? Will we hold fast the little church out at the end? Is important to understand. Because God sent them a letter. And here's the letter that God sent to us who will be at the end of the age. In verse 7 of chapter 3 he says, "To the angel of the church of Philadelphia write these things," he says, "He who is holy and he that is true, who has the key of David, and who opens and no one shuts, and shuts and no one opens. I know your works. See, I've set before you an open door, so no one can shut it. For you have a little strength, and you've kept my word, and have not denied my name. Indeed, I'll make those of the synagogue of Satan, who say they are Jews and are not, but lie. Indeed, I'll make them come and worship before your feet, to know that I have loved you. Because you've kept my command to persevere, I will also keep you from the hour of trial that will come on the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. Behold, I come quickly." And he says, "Hold fast what you have, that no one takes your crown. He who overcomes, I'll make him a pillar in the temple of my God. And he'll go out no more, and I'll write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, New Jerusalem, that comes down out of heaven from my God. And I'll write on him my new name. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. And so today I ask us to hear the letter written to us by God and not the one that the devil will send us. Let's hear what the Spirit says to the churches.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you found the message beneficial. If you would like to know more about the Eternal Church of God, we would like to hear from you. You may contact us at 1-800-723-6108. We also invite you to visit our website at eternalcog.org. Once again, thanks for listening.